Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to British Indie Film Club, a new limited podcast series brought to you by BIFA and Little White Lies magazine, where we meet some of the most exciting voices from the British independent film world. I'm Leila Latif.
And I'm Karis Aldridge. And today we are going to be speaking to actor Papa Asiedu about his career on stage and screen and his favourite British film. So as previous listeners already know, each episode we'll be meeting a talented actor or director to find out how they got their break in film, what they love most about their profession, and what the future holds. To celebrate BIFA's 25th birthday, we'll also be asking our guests to discuss a film from the BIFA archives, either a cult classic or a contemporary gem from the past 25 years.
For those of you who are regular listeners to Truth and Movies, you may recognise me. I'm a film critic, broadcaster and columnist.
And I'm a film sales exec and podcast host. I've worked across film sales, marketing and distribution on UK independent films and participated in the Creative England Producing Course, which supports emerging UK producers.
So this week we have the wonderful BAFTA and Emmy-nominated Papa Asiedu, who listeners will recognise from a number of massive projects, including critically celebrated BBC and HBO show I May Destroy You, the sci-fi thriller The Lazarus Project, Kiri, Men, and the most recent series of Black Mirror in an episode titled Demon 79. I don't know about you, Karis, that was... Demon 79 was the best episode of Black Mirror in years, I think. Definitely the best of the season for me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. Oh, I don't know if I... Yeah, I'm trying to think if it was my favourite of the series. It would be probably tied up there with Joan is Awful, just because that is such a fun one. But definitely a really, really great episode. And I think a bit more reminiscent of the early Black Mirror stuff as well.
Yeah, before it got too, like, unspeakably bleak. But it is interesting to think that, like, you know, something like Black Mirror now has, like, such big stars on it. We had, like, Selma Hayek in the series, Cate Blanchett, well, kind of, briefly. You know, like, Aaron Paul, Josh Hartnett. Like, there doesn't seem to be that distinction between what makes you a movie actor and a TV actor. I mean, it's kind of been going on for a while, but it really feels that that boundary has broken.
Absolutely. I feel like for me, the biggest test of that was Harrison Ford in Shrinking and actually Meryl Streep in Big Little Lies, because I think they are actors who are so known as like film actors. And to see them on a smaller screen, I don't know why that felt like such a big deal. But yeah, I think a lot of that comes with the fact that prestige TV is really at an all-time high at the moment. And I think for the ability of actors to be able to indulge in the character development of something over a limited series of 6 to 10 episodes as opposed to 90 minutes is something that they love and want to do more of. And yeah, like budgets are huge for prestige TV now. So I think that a lot of these film actors are like, hell yeah, I'm probably better paid. I don't know. I actually don't know that. So don't quote me on that.
I don't know that I will ever recover from the fact that we didn't get a season 2 of I May Destroy You. But there is some good stuff in the works. I mean, part of my work is I review TV, and there is a really, really excellent show called Dreaming While Black, which I think is going to at least a little bit fill that void for us, and very much going into those themes of like being a creative black person within these industries, like how you kind of get treated in various different ways, but also that like exploration of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman and what it means to kind of almost have like a solidarity within a community that is in no way a monolith. I'm very excited for you to see that. But Karis, if you go to see Talk To Me, I'm not going to hang out with you for a few weeks because I'm going to need you to recover for a while.
I'm so scared. Yeah, no, I will let you know immediately. It'll probably be like a very shaky voice note of me just being like, I will never be the same. But yeah, no, that sounds really good. I'm excited to hear more about that. Honestly, interviewing Papa was a very surreal experience. It was a Zoom conversation, which I think actually worked in my favor, because if I'd seen him in person, I think I would have combusted a little bit, because I'm also a huge, huge fan of I May Destroy You and think his work in that was fantastic. I know that him and Michaela Cole went to uni together and they've been like long-term friends and collaborators and stuff. So I think he's very like cool and nonchalant about it. Like, yeah, I just did this project my friend did and wrote or whatever. But yeah, I was like, I'm sad that I couldn't dig into it more with him because we had such a short amount of time to chat. But yeah, I was just like, oh my God, tell me more. Kwame, I love you. Oh, that's what's going on in my head, obviously. Professional. I wish there was more. I think we all just need a bit more Michaela Cole in our life generally, don't we? She's such a talent.
She's incredible. And listeners, do not fear. I have listened to the audio. It is a brilliant interview. And at no point does she call him Kwame.
Great. Okay. So, Papa, thank you so, so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, it's fantastic to be here, man. I love this podcast. So I felt very, very privileged to be invited to be a part of it.
No, we're so excited to have you on this. And listeners will recognise you from a number of massive projects that you've been a part of, including, you know, the critically celebrated BBC and HBO show I May Destroy You, sci-fi thriller The Lazarus Project, Kiri, Alex Garland's Men, and many, many more. Without trying to like embarrass you, because I realise it must be weird to hear all of your accomplishments back at you. You know, you're BAFTA and Emmy nominated, you're a winner of an Independent Spirit Award, and in only a decade, you've already got 27 acting credits under your belt, which is pretty damn impressive. Because you are,
oh my God,
you're booked and busy.
I'm trying to pay mortgage out here, you know. So
we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. We've got to do what we can.
Yeah,
you know?
We're all feeling it, man. We're all feeling it.
But you know, your projects, which I'm hoping that we'll get a chance to dig into, are all working with, you know, some of the best UK filmmakers and showrunners, which must be an absolute dream on your part, I imagine. So yeah, I wanted to rewind, go back early doors in your career and kind of talk a little bit about your training at Guildhall. I don't know, is it right that you actually turned down a place at UCL for medicine to take on a very prestigious role at Guildhall? Is that true?
I actually turned down a role at UCL to do medicine, to do nothing, actually, to do a year out, and I had nothing planned. So that was the real madness. You know, it's different if you're like, I'm saying no to that, and you're like, hey, I'm going to this great drama school, so don't worry, it's all good. But when you're saying no to that and you're like, yeah, I'm gonna work in the co-op pharmacy around the corner for quid an hour, my mum wanted to get my head tested. But like, yeah, I think anyone's very lucky if they know what they want to do at that age, you know, at 17, 18 years old. And I was fortunate that I kind of had a little bit of a kind, not even an epiphany, but at least like moment of inspiration of what my life could look like, you know. But it could have turned out very differently.
Yeah, I mean, it turned out very, very well. So I feel like, you know, trust your gut on that one. And I feel like it's interesting because I think it's kind of debated whether or not how important it is to train professionally and like whether or not it's a good idea to go to a drama school and how paramount it is to, you know, like an actor's success. I was wondering from your perspective, like what was your experience of Guildhall and like what were the big pros and cons of being there?
I mean, the pros are very pro and the cons are very con, you know. Like I really do not think that there is one size fits all entry point into this industry or as a foundation for this career. You know, like I think some people knew, I really had to go to drama school because I really didn't know anything at all. I didn't know any actors. I didn't really know anything about how like television or film or theater was made. I really thought it was about like speaking as loud as you can and using your hands as much as you could, you know. There was a very rudimentary basis of my, if you saw me performing at 18 years old, like you wouldn't have said that this guy would still be here 10, 12 years later. But for me, yeah, Guildhall, it's the first time I was in a room with people who who respected craft, you know, and respected the idea of acting being an artistry, and that required like an understanding of your body and an understanding of your voice and text work. And yeah, I mean, it meant I started going to watch plays, and I started watching films in a different way, and started like following actors and so on and so forth. So for me, I had to do it. But like a lot of the actors that I've worked with, that a lot of the best actors I've worked with have not done that, you know. So it's a different kettle of fish for each individual person.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it definitely really depends on, you know, your background and the type of things that you're interested in. But yeah, that's really fascinating. And I feel like it was for you also a great crash course in theatre and Shakespeare. I mean, if you look at, again, your body of work, you've worked in A Midsummer Night's Dream, King Lear. You played the titular role in Hamlet, age only 25 years old, which is insane. And more recently, the Olivier-nominated show A Number at the Old Vic. I'm always really interested about acting for theatre and acting on screen. Do you find that your method or your process when you're approaching a character is very different for the two?
I don't really think so, if I'm honest. Like, I always want to do the other when I'm doing one. So when I'm doing a play, I always want to be doing a film or a TV. And when I'm doing a TV, I always want to be doing a play, you know. So I've just been shooting for maybe 8 months or something like that, and I'm about to do a play and I'm really excited about it, you know. But I reckon about like probably 3 days into that play, I'm gonna be like, oh my god, I need to get back on set. I think the pursuit is the same, if I'm honest. Like, you're really about like finding, you're building a scaffolding or building a foundation of a character that's rooted in truth and rooted in authenticity. And both mediums are very unforgiving if you don't do that, you know. So like if you're on set and what you're doing is not truthful, the camera will just see it, you know. Any thought that flickers across your eyes that isn't quite in line with what the character's going through, the camera will pick it out and expose you. It's exactly the same in theater when you're on stage. If you're not fully committed to what you're doing, or if you're not in synergy with the other actors and with the audience that you're sharing that space with, the audience, you lose them. You start seeing people like shuffling in their chairs and they start coughing. No one's laughing at the bits that are meant to be funny. No one's crying at the bits that are meant to be sad. And you can always feel it in the applause at the end of a bad play. Like, the applause is like polite as opposed to enthusiastic, you know. So I think that the endeavor is always, for something for me at least, is always like at the top, to find something that's truthful and authentic before thinking about, is it screen, is it stage.
And I actually listened to a really interesting podcast of you. It's like an Actors on Actors with you and David Tennant. I don't actually know how long ago it was recorded, but it was really cool because obviously he's also played Hamlet, and you guys really came to that character at very different times in your career. And I was wondering what it's like taking on such an iconic character where we've seen so many iterations of it. Do you feel like an immense pressure to make it your own?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, for me, it was a different pressure because, like, at the time that I was doing it, Benedict Cumberbatch had just done it in London to great acclaim. Andrew Scott was about to do it in London. I think Oscar Isaac was about to do it in New York. So there were these kind of like behemoths of the industry who are all like giving their Danes, whatever you want to say. And whereas like for me, like you said, I was 25, no one knew who I was, and I was doing at the Royal Shakespeare Company, you know, the home of Shakespeare. So I mean, the pressure comes with like, who do you think you are to be able to be taken on this thing that is meant to be the realm of like, you know, these names, famous, whatever. But the pressure was also different because people didn't know who I was. The expectation was different. So I was able to kind of just like give my own interpretation or give my own. I was able to really just concentrate on doing the play as opposed to being a famous person doing the play. Mm. You know, which is a different challenge. You know, like you're dealing with people. Like I remember with Benedict's one particularly, there was a real problem with people's phones and people like recording him doing to be or not to be, or which bit of the play that how they'd like chopped it up and everything. Whereas with me, people were like, I was just lucky people turned up in the first place. You know, so yeah, the pressure was great. It was great, and the scrutiny was also great because there's a lot of like, I suppose, political language around like the choice of me particularly as a black man doing it. So a lot of my work was trying to like shut that out and concentrate on the job at hand.
Yeah, because that must be quite difficult when you're like, there's a lot of, yeah, the way that it was kind of spun from like a media perspective, that must be quite like a difficult thing to kind of figure out. I wanted to talk about short films because of your 27 credits, I was like really happily surprised to see that you've got a lot of short films on there. Because I think that short films are, I don't know, they're such a labor of love. And I think they're really perceived in the industry as a great way of showcasing someone's talent, if that's, you know, acting or writing or directing, or if it's a stepping stone to making that short a feature. But yeah, you've worked on some fantastic shorts. I mean, you've got Stand Still, Bicycle Thief, Exit Plan, and of course, Femme in 2021, which won the BIFFA for Best Short Film. And it's this very kind of subversive and unsettling story about Jordan, who gets into a car with this flirtatious drug dealer, and the night takes this very kind of dangerous turn. And I thought it was interesting to bring up Hamlet, actually, because when I was reading like critical reviews, a lot of people made some kind of parallels between Hamlet and Femme in the way that it's also a bit of a revenge tragedy where the protagonist is seeking justice for his father. And I was wondering if you'd ever made that association, or like what your kind of hot take would be on that.
I got no hot takes whatsoever, man, at all. My takes are cold as hell. But like, I mean, like, yeah, it's retrospectively that you kind of like draw the links between projects like that. And the thing about Femme, right, is from the first moment I met Sam and Ping, who are the writers and directors, there was a synergy in us, you know, like Ping particularly had worked a lot in theatre, and this was like his first kind of like foray into the screen. And Sam had like written on industry and, you know, had been an actor. And so there was a lot that we had going on. We vibed a lot on a mental level and an experiential level, you know. So I just really wanted to, you know, I mean, you're so right, like shorts are a labor of love, but there's great freedom in shorts, you know, because they're so focused, and because you haven't got the pressure of kind of like carrying a story over a 90 minute arc or whatever. You can really, really, really like drill down into detail and really drill down into finding something that's nuanced and impactful, you know. And I think they did that masterfully, and it's no surprise to me that it ended up doing as well as it did. And then, you know, they went on to make it into the feature, and that's also incredible. And they're going to have like such exciting careers. There are a lot of people that are very excited about their talent, and rightly so.
And it's so interesting you say that, because I was about to say, I think shorts are such an exploration of discipline. The fact that you have to create a whole story, compelling characters in literally 10 to 20 pages, is that what attracts you to the medium of storytelling?
Yeah, I think it's and also you're doing it for no money. Like, you really are doing it for no money.
Yeah.
You're doing it in like 2 days, and like there aren't any dressing rooms or toilets or food, or, you know, but like there's like some, there's passion and there's commitment and there's community in the room, which actually really reminds me of doing plays, you know. Similarly, like, no one's doing plays to get rich, you know, but like people are doing plays to move people, or people are doing plays to make people laugh. It really underpins the power of the story. And I think it's the same with shorts. And I've watched amazing shorts, you know, and been part of amazing shorts as well. So I really hope that's something that continues to be a feature in my career, because I don't at all kind of like look down my nose at it as some sort of lesser art form. I think it's actually like, it's just something that's different. It's a different way of working to television or more long form film.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you feel like it's at all harder from an acting point of view to approach a character when you've got such little source text to work from? Because you're having to, well, I imagine you're having to like create an entire backstory for someone from like, you know, a little line on a script. Do you find that more difficult, or is it again more freeing?
I don't think it's harder, because number one, you've got to do that anyway. Whether it's short or long, you've got to do that anyway. Otherwise, like, it's kind of like what I said earlier on. If you don't really know what your character's doing, or where they came from, or how, you know, what happened like before the film started, what's going to happen after the film ends, if you don't do that kind of work, it's going to be thin. It's going to be two-dimensional. It's not going to have depth and nuance. So it's actually exactly the same thing. And we've just actually seen like a shorter snapshot of what that character is going through, you know. And ideally it leaves you wanting more, you know. It leaves you wanting to see more, or it leaves you, it's got that kind of titillating quality to it, that kind of like gets your senses piqued that makes you want to come back for more. A good short does that.
Anyway. Yeah, and Femme absolutely does that. And Ewan Harris are so good in it. It's really, really great. I would recommend to anyone who hasn't had the chance to watch it. I feel like I would massively kick myself if we don't talk very briefly about I May Destroy You, because honestly, when I say this, it is one of my favourite TV shows ever, I think will remain to be. It's, you know, obviously you got nominated for the Emmy and the BAFTA. It's BAFTA. The BAFTA.
The Emma and the BAFTA.
The BAFTA. That's what they call it. That's going to be a new thing.
The BAFTA.
And it's with one of your old friends and collaborators, Michaela Cole. You guys worked on Black Earth Rising together. I also really love that. What was the most important thing about your character that you wanted audiences to take away from it? Because, you know, he goes through some really, you know, difficult and horrific experiences. Yeah, what was that main thing you wanted audiences to take away from it?
I think the thing about Kwame is that he's like forever, he's forever surprising, you know, like every single aspect of him that seems to like play into a stereotype or an expectation gets debunked over the course of the, you know, we had 12 episodes, which were like 12 short films, you know, but like every single time you thought he was this kind of guy, he became that kind of guy. And every time you thought he was going in this direction, he started going in that direction. And I really wanted to allow those, I suppose, the openness of his destiny to remain so, even as that big things happened in his life. I didn't want him to ever become defined by any one thing that happened to him. And I think him as a character also wanted that for himself. He wanted to have freedom to be able to identify him in whatever way he wanted and to be able to be unique in that and self-defined in that. And yeah, I think it's definitely testament to the soulfulness of Michaela's writing and her understanding of humanity and people that helped to make that happen.
I feel like when you're talking about it really reminds me of that thing. Edward Enninful, when you guys met, he described you as like a force of change and challenging the stereotype of Black men. And I think it kind of ties into what you're saying now. I feel like with Kwame and also with, you know, Femme and your character in Men, for example, you seem drawn to stories that examine masculinity or discuss vulnerability and sexuality in men in a really nuanced way. Is that something that is really paramount to you, or really, you know, it's a conscious choice in every project that you look to take on?
I don't know. I think in every character, I'm definitely looking for what's on the other side of the coin. I'm looking to explore what their thoughts are when someone's not looking, or what they're like when the mask is on, and what happens when they take it off. You know, like I am very drawn to characters that have complexity and that have conflict within them. I don't know I don't know how that speaks to my own character and my own life, but I'm drawn to that when I watch shows and when I watch films and when I listen to music and when I, you know, watch art and all of that. I'm always like drawn to the unexpected and to the original. So I guess in a way that's true.
And obviously this is the BIFFA podcast, and what we love to do is to ask our guests to pick a favourite film from the BIFFA archive. And you decided to go for Boiling Point, which could quite accurately describe me in this London heatwave right now. But yeah, it was released in 2021 by Philip Barantini. It is a sizzling and frenetic kitchen drama that is just one tension-drenched shot. Why did you decide to choose this film? I mean, I love it, but yeah, why did you decide to choose this as your favourite BIFFA film?
I obviously think it's a fantastic film, so I guess that's why. But like, yeah, I think it's more to do with like the way it made me feel the first time I watched it, and I've watched it maybe like 3-4 times, but like the first time I watched it, it really made me feel in the same way as I feel when I'm in a theatre or in a gig or, you know, watching a sports game, tennis match or whatever, when like collectively everyone's holding their breath, you know, when you feel like nobody in the room has breathed for like 30 seconds, you know, that level of tension, I think, is very, very hard to generate in other people, to the point that they stop thinking about, you know, their own bodily functions. You know, like there's no way, I defy you to watch that film and to be scrolling on Instagram or to be, you know, thinking about what you're having for dinner later. Or maybe you will be thinking about what you're having for dinner, but to be thinking about like saying else. You know, it I think it's a masterclass in generating and sustaining tension and the concentration of a viewer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel a lot of that kind of hinges on this unbelievable performance by Stephen Graham, in the way that he's able to kind of the rise and fall of that tension that is, yeah, again, very like nuanced, and that it's not just one at one stage the whole time. You know, he's able to kind of move through it in a really interesting way. And obviously it's being made into a TV show. Do you think you'll be watching the TV show?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, like, you're right, Stephen's performance in it is fantastic, but like every single performance is fantastic. You know,
absolutely.
If you like, Vinette Robinson's incredible in it, Zuka Hoyle is incredible in it, Hannah Waters is incredible in it, like everybody, like Jason Fleming, like everybody is like it. And that's the thing about like this like roving camera, you're never taken out of it, because like there's just like a relentless realism and naturalism wherever the camera lands, you know. So even on the smaller characters, or even on those kind of like more sideline scenes, I'm doing inverted commas for people who are listening, there's something so like fully formed and fully lived in. The opening scene with Tommy Coombs is like so spot on. It's just like fantastic. I think it's fantastically performed, fantastically directed, and fantastically executed.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like also, I felt like it was a really interesting choice for you specifically as well, because technically the fact that it is a one-shot film, it does feel like this immersive play, like we feel like sure. We are within it as well. And I think, does that also kind of lend itself to the theater roots, and like what you were saying as well about how it's such a collective that makes it so sure. great and so immersive to watch? Do you think that's another reason that you feel so kind of connected to the story or so involved in it?
Yeah, I guess I've never done a one-shot film before, but like I can just imagine like the stress, or imagine the stakes, you know. You say one line wrong, or you like hit one wrong mark, and you've got to start again. And I'm pretty sure with these films, like you only end up getting to do like two or three takes of it. I think with this, they did maybe two or four or something like that. I think maybe. And yeah, I'm always just like endlessly impressed by the technical feat that is achieved to make it happen and make it look so seamlessly easy, you know. So yeah, I'm sure that plays into it a bit as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a fantastic film, and yeah, if anyone hasn't watched it already, get to it, because it's on Netflix, so you haven't got a reason not to. Yeah, also Black Mirror, I know we've got like literally about 2 minutes left, and I'm sad that we haven't been able to chat about your new Black Mirror episode in more detail. Demon 79, which I managed to watch yesterday, is so good. It's amazing. Set in Northern England, 1979, about a meek sales assistant who is told she must commit these terrible acts to prevent disaster. Firstly, I hope you were able to keep that unbelievable outfit, because I feel like that would be your Halloween sorted. Did you?
Yeah,
surely.
Yeah. You know what? We like it looked great, but like we shot that last summer, you know, and it was still a heatwave situation to what we're going through right now. So that was it was cloying. It was a tight fitting outfit. So I don't think anyone wants to be near it.
Oh no.
Smell wise, I mean.
Okay, that demystifies the whole thing. Okay. And what was it? What was it like working? Was Charlie Brooker, was he on set? Were you able to like work with him and talk about the character and stuff a lot with him?
Yeah. Charlie M. Bisher, who Bisher Kayali co-wrote it with Charlie. They were both on set quite a lot, and super chill, super lovely, like what you see is what you get type people, you know. The kind of process is kind of shrouded in mystery anyway, because it's Black Mirror, and we were the first one up. We shot ours before everybody else, so we had the full attention of everybody. I don't know if the other casts were as lucky, but we had the full attention of everyone throughout our shoot, so we were very fortunate in that sense. And yeah, it was such a joyful, incredible experience. I've got to act with Anjana Varsan, who is just like one of the most extraordinary actors in this country, in the world really right now, and will go on to do many, 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 many fantastic things. But yeah, I loved it so much.
Oh, it's so great. And I feel like I've been looking online, and I think it's already ranked as one of the best of the season. I think a lot of people really enjoy it, because it's kind of going back to the early Black Mirror stuff. And I absolutely loved it. I think it's great, and just very exciting. I realize I think we're running out of time, so I'll leave it there. But I know I'm like, I could talk about this forever, but no, thank you. Thank you so much. Massively, massively appreciate your time as always and digging into your incredible career. And I know you've got amazing things coming up. So yeah, thank you and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you so much. So nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. You too. Thank you. Bye.
Karis, I absolutely love that. I am only slightly green with envy that you got to talk to such an incredible talent and a delightfully charming man. But yeah, his choice of boiling point, I don't know why I found that surprising, because I suppose I just think boiling point is about my life, so why would anybody else be interested?
Like, what? It's about me? Yeah, no, I'm so happy that he chose boiling point, because I watched this movie, it's how old is it now? It's 2021. So it's been 18 months, almost 2 years. And I was blown away by it and watched it again. And yeah, I just absolutely adore it. So when he was like, boy, but I was like, so excited to dig into this with you more. But especially now with this kind of explosion of seeing more chefing on screen and how it's captured the attention of so many people with the success of The Bear as well. Also, do you remember that we were sat next to the director, Philip Barantini, at the Biffers?
We were. Yeah. Yeah. No, he was on the main jury with me. Very, very nice man.
Lovely man. Yeah.
Very, very talented. But like, I think for me, I spent almost all of my 20s working as a chef, working in catering, working in restaurants, doing various things, working in events. And I felt like cinema very rarely captured what it was actually like. And with him, I think you can really see his connection to the material. I mean, like, I was not surprised when I spoke to Philip to discover that he had previously been a chef, because I think unless you have been in the full nightmare that life is, don't regret my 20s. Absolutely never want to spend 1 minute as a chef ever again. But it is so stressful. It is so unpleasant. And it is so kind of viscerally, every bit of adrenaline is going through your body and you just cannot believe that the night will ever end. And that's what he kind of gets in this. Yeah. And I worked in many restaurants. So this is not just the one. This is strangely just the universal experience of being a chef.
No, I totally agree. I mean, I would love to actually hear some of the places that you've worked, if you're allowed to say. I don't know whether or not you want to air that dirty laundry out on a public podcast. But I have also had my foray in hospitality in my like early working years, and then kind of doing it throughout uni and stuff. I famously worked at TGI Fridays. Shout out TGI's. Had to sing the happy birthday song probably about 50 times a day, and then would come home stinking of like just grease and food, which is another part of it. But no, I mean, even for me watching that as like a little TGI's girl, I was watching it being like, this feels very close to home. Like he you're completely right in that. The fact that it is semi-autobiographical and he's brought a lot of his own experiences to the movie is why a lot of people see it and immediately connect to it, because whatever part of hospitality you've been a part of, you understand that utter chaos. And it's just, you're so right, the level of stress and adrenaline pumping through your body when you're on a shift or whatever it is that you're doing is just so perfectly captured. And I think that is partly the ensemble performance, which is incredible in this, but also the fact that he did decide to do it as a one-shot take, which I think is a really brave decision for as a filmmaker, a first-time filmmaker, and just like technically is very, very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, something like Birdman seems to like really just be like the magic of movies. These things are not actually done in one take. These are seamlessly done, which in itself is like an incredible skill. But I mean, this is genuinely one take. But I don't think that's often the case, because even like going back to a film I love, which is Hitchcock's Rope, I believe they've kind of been a little bit clever, and that's like 3 or 4 takes. And that's also not a terribly, as much as I love it, not a terribly dynamic film. It's basic. It does feel like you're kind of watching a staged play. The camera doesn't move in the same way that this does. Part of that, of course, is because of, you know, not having to shoot on film. But like, it's really interesting to see someone like push themselves as much as Philip Barranti has done, because he could have kind of taken the easy way out and made it basically one, you know, seem like one take. But yeah, they probably did do it. And like, yes, I'm now looking back on this film, looking back at my time in hospitality and thinking like, was I in a cult? Because in a way it's a cult movie. Like that everybody's just kind of tied up in this like utter madness, but is like determined to serve it.
Completely, yes. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So yeah, they rehearsed. They didn't have that much time to rehearse. I think they had 3 to 4 weeks to rehearse everything. BIFFA award-winning director of photography, Matthew Lewis, who did all of the camera work there, which was fantastic. But yeah, and then in between rehearsals, the main actors would spend a bit of time, which I think is something that you mentioned that you've done, but kind of chefing for a few hours in Michelin star restaurants to just kind of get the basics down to make it obviously look believable that they are actually chefing while they're doing it.
Yes, I saw some excellent folding techniques. I see that it all
oh good, okay.
45 degree angles with the whisk, because in those restaurants they will scream at you if you don't. And some good knife skills. I was pretty impressed. I mean, okay. I was revisiting some trauma, but like, yes, they were very convincing.
It was as triggering as it was impressive.
It was. And it's like, I think if you've worked in that world, there's such a kind of inauthentic depiction of it often on screen. I'm thinking of like Monica from Friends, who seems to have free time all the time and never be like calloused and dealing with third degree burns up and down her arms and like, you know, all of those things, and has a perfect blowout, which I assure you, if you spend all of your time in front of a stove, does not happen.
Does not happen, yeah.
But in terms of your role, like, I mean, there's a million films about the magic of movie making. I mean, like, have you ever seen anything that actually also quite authentically captures that, you know, that world or that stress?
Yeah. What would you do if I was like, Babylon? Yeah, there was just... just loads of, you know, drugs and madness. No, I will confirm that I've never experienced anything close to Babylon. It's a very good question. Do you know what? I think that because of the side of the industry that I am in, which is slightly odd, but like film sales and distribution, it's not production. So I'm not on set every single day. I'm not obviously like an actual filmmaker, so I'm not, you know, doing that kind of stuff every day. So a lot of it is actually just being in an office, which, shocking, is not that cinematic. So, but I am thinking about it, and I would say one thing, the annoying thing is that it's not actually a film about our industry, but I would say I have worked with some people. The Devil Wears Prada. I have been Andy, and I have worked for a very, what's her name, Miranda Priestly-esque person in my life, a couple of Miranda Priestly-esque people in my life. I think that kind of, even though that's obviously fashion and whatever, that setup and those dynamics and that kind of like level of dedication to the job where you kind of always feel like you're pretty switched on, because especially in film you're often talking to people in different time zones and things like that, that I definitely see on screen, and like that's my trigger. I'm like, oh god, that reminds me of like me however many years ago. So yeah, I would say, I know it's not film, but that's probably for me and my personal experience the closest that I've seen on screen.
Oh god, I actually had a good friend who worked as Anna Wintour's assistant for 2 years in New York, and
no way.
That plus the terrible kitchens and the Michelin stars that I worked for, I will have to tell you about off screen.
Can't wait.
Not here for being sued by high powered listeners who we might be kind of slightly slandering, but yes. It's one of life's great questions, isn't it? Like, are you making inroads in your career, or have you accidentally joined a cult?
Yeah. It's definitely worth taking a step back and asking yourself that from time to time. Hopefully anyone listening to this podcast who needs that moment of realization, you're welcome. We've just given it to you.
Yeah. And if you're going to join one, you know, Papa in that white outfit in Black Mirror, I mean, that's, I probably could be convinced of quite a lot by him.
That outfit, yeah, I feel like I was really bewildered by the outfit and Boney M generally. But yeah, I was like, oh my God, tell me more about the outfit. That would be a perfect Halloween outfit. Like, what are we doing with it now? Does it have a pride of place in your wardrobe? But I'm sad to hear that it was like a 40 degree day and that he was having probably the worst time of his life while shooting that. So poor man. But yeah.
Well, he suffered, you know, for a good reason. I don't want to be like, yeah, like, you know, Hitchcock was not particularly nice to his actors and he gave us Rope, which I very much enjoyed. So if Papa has to endure some sweaty white wings in a Boney M tribute, I'm very glad that he's willing to kind of put himself on the line for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And his co-star, and I really don't want to butcher her name, she's so amazing, is Anjana Vasan, who's also, again, to link back to our previous episode, the main star of We Are Lady Part. She is so talented. My God. Yeah, if you don't know her, she recently won an Olivier Award for Streetcar Named Desire. She's everywhere, really. She's in film, she's on stage, she's on screen. I think she was in quite a lot of the recent series of Killing Eve as well, wasn't she? I think. Was that her?
I don't think anybody watched the recent series of Killing Eve. I mean, that's where the hierarchy of TV and film maybe should be.
Unfortunately, yeah. Well, sorry. But no, she's just so fantastic. And she has such a like long career ahead of her, for sure. But yeah, both of them together are great. And obviously, it is set in the late 70s. And actually, to bring it back to Hitchcock, it is very reminiscent. It's very Hitchcockian. Is that the right word to use? In its film devices. And I think that's what it's kind of trying to emulate, I suppose, is that kind of era of horror and thriller. And I think Charlie Brooker has actually spoken about how he's written, you know, obviously it's called Black Mirror, but that this is a kind of deviation. It's called like the Red Mirror episodes that are leaning a bit more into that horror thriller space. And yeah, despite the fact that it is set in the late 70s, obviously a lot of it is, you know, very politically charged and to do with a lot of kind of xenophobia. And it's a lot of stuff that I think still feels very relevant now, which I guess is kind of the genius of Black Mirror. So yeah, it's a really cool episode. I really enjoyed it. And obviously Boney M, which you just can't go wrong.
But yeah, I mean, but it's also like really exciting to see, you know, Papa talks a little bit about how he goes back to like short films, but there are kind of other actors that are willing to kind of do a similar thing. I mean, we have Wes Anderson, he's doing kind of a short film for Netflix coming out. And like Almodovar just made a film that I'm very excited to see. I believe a gay cowboy movie with Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal that's coming out. Like, it just feels like things are a little bit more fluid. There isn't quite that like hierarchy of the form.
I agree. And I hope that we see more of that. Yeah, the cowboy short with Ethan Hawke and Pedro. When I tell you I was heartbroken to not catch that in Cannes, like genuine tears falling from my eyes. I am so excited to watch it. I think it's going to be so good. But no, totally agree. I think that for a long time, short film has been, I don't know, a bit sidelined from the conversation, a bit sidelined from, I mean, it's definitely there in award shows, but I don't know. I'm really happy to see that it's having a bigger platform and that people are taking it more seriously, because I think there's an incredible exercise of discipline, I think, doing a short film and being able to craft a fully formed story in such a short space of time. So I actually think as a creative that it's really interesting. I know that Channel 4 have got a section which people should definitely check out, which is highlighting some of the best short films in the year. And they usually have that on 4AD. So yeah, if you're not sure where to find short films, I mean, even YouTube is a really good place to find things. I mean, Riz Ahmed's The Long Goodbye, which won an Oscar a couple of years ago now, can't remember, is available on YouTube. And yeah, you can kind of just dip your toes in and see what you like, because they're incredibly varied. And you can get like documentary short film as well. So yeah, there's a lot to uncover in the short film world, for sure.
The first way I was introduced to Remy Weeks, who made one of my favorite horror films of recent years, His House, was through his short film, which Channel 4 commissioned. But I guess kind of the thing that I end up kind of not dismissing them as, but kind of assuming what they are, is kind of proof of concepts. Like, it's like, oh, this is the thing that you do as a filmmaker to show that you can do something. And then you get your feature, which is like the proper thing. And like, obviously, that's not the case. That's just my silly biases coming into it. But from your perspective, I mean, being the sort of powers that be in the film industry as an executive, like, are they important? Like, are people looking at short films and people getting big opportunities off the back of them?
Look, I would say your perception is not 100% wrong. Like, I would definitely say that from, you know, if you're a film salesperson, an executive, a financier, an acquisitions person, and someone is coming to you with an idea saying, look, I want to make my feature debut, obviously that seems incredibly risky because you don't have anything else to base their work on, because at that point they haven't made another feature film before. So short films are a perfect example of, yeah, being able to, you know, exhibit your craft and your, yeah, nature in telling a story. And also your ability to work within budgets is something that's very, very important, because Christopher Nolan is always a person who is always under budget and is like celebrated for that, I think. So, you know, if you're a filmmaker who can work meticulously to a budget and sometimes come in under budget, then people are gonna wanna work with you because it is an expensive thing to be making films. So yes, I think that short films are incredibly important in that, and almost acting as a portfolio for financiers and producers and people to say, look, okay, we can see this person's vision, we can understand what they're doing, and then gives them a bit more confidence going into a feature film. And I think actually we mentioned in Nida's episode that a lot of the people that she worked with on her short film then ended up working on the feature. So yeah, you can bring like the same team with you as well. So it does become an incredibly valuable experience.
Yeah, I mean, does that also kind of happen the same way with actors? I mean, I'm trying to think of an example that's happened recently, but like, I guess because they're kind of a little bit inside baseball, I suppose, these short films, people see them at festivals, people kind of see them within the industry, and like, you know, it's people that are really, really invested in kind of the cutting edge of cinema that are watching them. So I guess there are more opportunities for the filmmakers and the actors so much, because not so many people are going to like get their eyes on you in something.
Yeah, I think if you're an actor, again, you can definitely use it in a showreel, anything that you do for a short film. So it's definitely very helpful. But yeah, Papa is funny because he is talking about, you know, that he really does do it because he loves it, because the truth of the reality is that short films are usually on a shoestring budget, barely any money. He's like, you know, most actors are likely not even getting paid, or if they are, it's, you know, a very minimal amount to be able to actually just get it off the ground. So they're really doing it because they probably have an attachment to the filmmakers or an attachment to the material itself, as opposed to wanting to do it to showcase them or, you know, platform there, or like kind of as a stepping stone for their career. It's more about probably them as an actor wanting to challenge that material and see what they can do with it.
Well, I know that you're not a big horror person, Karis, but there is actually a short film that I did see called The Blackening a few years ago, which is written and starring this guy, Dwayne Perkins. And it kind of got taken up, and it's coming out in a few weeks. And the director is Tim Story, who is not someone that you go to for, you know, brilliant tiny indie movies. He is like the billion-dollar blockbuster guy. And I tell you, like, much like when I saw Papa in I May Destroy You, and I was just like, this guy is a star. This guy, Dwayne Perkins, is an absolute star. And it's like this incredible portrayal of like a queer black man who refuses to be a sidekick, refuses to kind of have himself sidelined and just serve the kind of needs of the other kind of more conventional main characters of the plot. And like, I just think so much exciting stuff has happened when it comes to portrayals of black men and portrayals of black queer men and black masculinity in general. Like, Papa really feels like he's been at the forefront of something quite special.
Firstly, that sounds incredibly excited. And I will be looking out for that. I need to just kind of have a talking to myself in the mirror and be like, stop being a massive baby and just go and watch things. Because there's loads of really cool horror films coming out. Talk to Me, which my friends have
Can't handle Talk to Me.
I know! This is the problem.
Horror comedy, The Blackening. I'm not...
Oh my God, I'm so annoyed because, yeah, it's close friends of mine who have like worked on it for the last 18 months and they invited me and I was like, I'm so sorry, but I am such a baby that I actually think that I will be mentally scarred if I watch this film, but I really want to watch it and I really want to support it. So I basically need to, I was going to say man up, but no, gendered. I need to just be better. I just need to be better. But yes, with Papa, I completely agree. And I think that I did mention it in my interview, but I thought that he did this interview with Edward Enville, who is the editor of British Vogue. And he spoke about how he was so kind of taken away with Papa because he is someone who is so unapologetic in exploring Black vulnerability and masculinity, which in a way that I think a lot of people might be scared to do or not have the opportunity to do. And I think you're totally right. He very much has placed himself really bravely at the forefront of that conversation because it's something that unfortunately we are starting to see more now. And again, like with Moonlight, which we spoke about in a previous episode, we are beginning to see this more in mainstream media, but definitely not enough. And I really, really think that it's really important. Again, it's always comes back to a question of like representation on screen and feeling seen on screen. And I think that for a lot of Black men, this is their reality, but that's not seen. It's what's generally seen is, you know, top boy and like, you know, that kind of version of masculinity. And, you know, it's really exciting that there are more spaces to explore that kind of queer masculinity. So yeah, I think Papa is very cool for that.
Yeah, and not to bring it all back to kind of TV again, like, so yes, Boiling Point is now available to watch on Netflix, as is Black Mirror. Highly recommend catching both. And am I right, Garrison, thinking that Boiling Point is going to be made into a TV show? I can't conceive of how, but like, I'm on board.
It is, obviously. Yeah, don't want to spoil the ending of Boiling Point if you haven't already seen it, but yes, the ending raise some questions, which I think are going to be answered in this 5-part series, which the BBC has recently announced. I remember when we were chatting to Philip, he was about to go into production. So yeah, it's all wrapped production. I think it will be coming to our screens very soon. I don't know if there's an exact date as of yet, but yeah, it should be over the next couple of months. But yeah, it will be following the same cast. So Vinette Robinson, who again won the BIFFA, she's a fantastic actress who stars across from Stephen Graham. She will be reprising her role, and I think it will be following her 6 months on from where the film ended. So very exciting. And if you're a big fan of that type of drama on screen, basically if you like things that make you feel like you're having a heart attack while you're watching them, then The Bear is also very good, which is on Disney Plus as well, which I think is exploring similar things but in the US.
Well, I mean, plenty of people to go away from. Yeah, I don't know that I can handle much more of a heart attack after having to rewatch Boiling Point, but you know, and kind of Uncut Gems in a good way, heart attack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. BIFFA celebrates, promotes and supports independent filmmaking and filmmakers in the UK. Keep up to date with latest releases and exciting names in independent film by following BIFFA on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube and Twitter.
This podcast was produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.